I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Welcome to Sick Boy, a podcast where we talk about what it's like to be sick. This week's guest is Jesse Hayman. We're going to dive into men's mental health. Let's talk about it.
Okay, cool. Before we like dive straight into things, can you tell the guys where you just were? Is that okay to say
yeah,
that?
Yeah,
okay,
I
sweet.
I can talk about where I was. So
a brothel?
I'm Jewish.
Okay.
Not the best Jew in the world, but I happen to be Jewish. But my family, parts of my family are pretty religious. And so the first Haman boy of my generation was just born. So I guess, sorry, the next generation. And they had a bris. A bris is where the boy gets the tip of his penis cut off. And it's a weird thing because you would think, like, take it to the hospital and leave him there and get it cut off. But they do it at a home. And they invite all friends and family.
Yeah,
so I was at this home.
Well, there's a Seinfeld episode about this.
Oh, yeah, for sure. There's got to be one. Yeah. We probably had 200 people there.
Whoa.
I stayed in the kitchen while it's happening, but like everyone gets quiet. They give it a little snip. And then I believe they give the baby a little bit of wine or whiskey. Like,
no way,
like a
really?
Painkiller, like off the rabbi's finger.
Are people trying to That's get crazy. Like a better view? Like 200 people in a house, are they like jostling for position to kind of like peek up over and see the?
It's kind of like a concert. There are those people that jostle for position that like want front row. And then there's me and my sister and whoever else that are like sitting on the couch in
we're
the
good.
Kitchen hanging out. Like, we're good.
We're good, thanks.
But yeah, it gives a little snip. And I was saying to Jeremy, and I don't know, don't quote me on this, but it used to be, and I believe it's still done by Orthodox rabbis, that they bit the tip of the penis off. Like they were.
How wild is that?
Really?
Dude, and I believe they still, like Orthodox Jewish people still do that.
Man.
An Orthodox Jew is like curly. They wear they wear hats and the long jacket.
I mean, it changes depending on ages and like who you are and what you're doing, but generally, yeah, an Orthodox Jew would usually be someone that you see wearing a hat they have the kids will have the payas, which is like the
curly sideburns. Yeah.
Tzitzit, which is like the like hangy thing. They're like a piece of fabric hanging from outside.
It with like
shorts.
A little knot at the bottom.
Yeah, exactly.
Are there any Orthodox Jews who don't like subscribe to the clothing side of things?
I would have assumed there's lots of them.
Yeah. Okay.
It would just be there's certain things like covering up and not like Orthodox man can't touch another woman other than his wife. Same thing with a woman. She can't shake the hand of a man.
It's all so
like
interesting.
Like,
eh? Wow. How you got to be real precise with a circumcision, I would assume. You know,
dude, it's so
like,
small.
Yeah, I would hope so.
Yeah. So, your teeth, you must have that down pat. If you're biting off the tip of a dick. You must have your really good.
How do you practice for it before your first time?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's
so
what
if
I'm
you
saying.
Want the like kicker,
yeah,
the kicker
yeah.
is you're supposed to plant it in your house, like
what
in the soil?
Really?
What?
Absolutely. So I was talking to my aunt today, and I'm like,
does a tree grow from
it? Are they planting it? Well, that's what I said. And I'm like, Shauna, where do you think like that's where penis trees come? And my aunt, who's like very conservative, is just like, yeah, that's where they make dick trees.
And you're like,
where did that come from?
We grew Jesse in this plant.
Okay, well, I think that's a good place to start. The bris. But Jesse, you are... you're a gentleman here living in Toronto, and you do a lot of work in the sort of like mental health sector, if you will.
Yep.
But not like from you're not like a medical professional by any means.
Not
I'm assuming.
All.
I'm
not
guessing. Why don't you tell people what you're up to these days?
What am I up to these days? I work for a youth mental health organization called Jack.org, which is probably the biggest thing that I'm up to, which essentially is the only network of young people and mostly students, national network across Canada that's essentially putting mental health in the hands of young people to ensure that they're a key part of the conversation for youth mental health across Canada. Most of the time what happens with like advocacy groups and organizations that are built to help something, they don't often include those people in as front and center, both in their thoughts and opinions, and make sure they're the key part of the change that's happening. And so essentially Jack.org is, we have 2,500 students across Canada that are trained leaders. So how do you identify barriers to positive mental health in your community? And then how do you build a plan to break them down year round? And so that's what those 2,500 leaders are doing. We have a bunch of different programming, but essentially it's putting it in the hands of young people, not only because we need them, they view what the issues are in a very different way, which changes from region to region, but that they deserve to be there. There's a lot of smart, smart young people around Canada that are doing incredible things, and we just want to bring them in, help them learn how to be better leaders and unleash them.
We just spoke with I don't know if she's a leader. I'm having a total mind blank.
Allie,
who suffers from panic attacks and anxiety, she was
at Jack.org. She's from Halifax.
Okay.
And we met at Jack.org, which is how we brought her into the podcast. I spoke at Jack.org Summit this year.
You were amazing.
And dude, amazing summit. Like, it's such a rad community. It's so cool to see all these, you know, young minds coming together and really looking to like make a huge difference. How did Jack.org start?
So Jack.org started because a young man went to first year university. His name was Jack Windler.
His name was Jack.org.
Yeah. and he was obviously struggled in first year university and took his own life. And no one knew anything was wrong. And so his parents had seen behavior change, but young men change quite a bit. And so he had backed off socially from friends. He had spent more time in his room playing video games, that sort of thing. But they didn't know that that was a warning sign, because we're not well-educated, well-educated enough to understand what to look out for. And if you do see something, how do you say something? He hadn't been to school for a couple months, and he ended up taking his own life. So his parents, Eric Windler and Sandra Hannington, started up Jack.org. Eric quit his job, sold his business, and started up Jack.org as the executive director. And basically his goal was, this shouldn't happen to other families. It shouldn't happen to young people. If you're struggling, you should be able to understand when you're struggling, because a lot of people just don't even recognize what's wrong with them and that there is something going on in your head that you need to take care of. But also, how do your peers recognize that you're struggling, and what do they do when they realize that you are? It's not your parents that are going to see it in a big time of transition. It's somebody else. And for anyone like Jack going forward, they wanted to make sure that young people know how to be there for their friends.
And I think it's awesome that this is a conversation that young people are having now, because I remember being in like junior high and high school, and mental health, the conversation about that was non-existent.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So like having that many people across Canada involved in an organization like this, that, and especially being a big part of fueling the conversation and leading the program, I think that's a huge step in the right direction.
Yeah. I went through, I really kind of related, the idea that for, Jack, that no one was able to kind of see the change because he's going through an adaptive period in his life where people are expecting change and it's hard to see. I went through a period of depression. I was never diagnosed with depression. I went through probably like a 6 month period, in my life, in high school, in my grade 11 year. And I moved away from home, went to a boarding school in the US, and I only realized in hindsight that that's what was happening, but no one in my life would have known.
Right.
Not a soul. Because I went to a new place and I didn't really know many people at school, so no one at school knew. I'm hundreds of miles away from home, no one knows. But just that idea that to in an era or in a time where it's non-existent, the conversation. So that's really cool work.
Did you understand then that you were going through something? Or
no, not in the slightest. Yeah. What my brain knew was that I felt way more comfortable coming back to my dorm room, which was a single room, and going to sleep.
You know what's super interesting about that, and you know about the whole story of Jack and kind of what he went through. Bridie, my wife, used to work as the facilitator for the Moksha Yoga teacher trainings.
Right.
And Moksha Yoga is a chain of hot yoga studios across the world, and so they hold like 3 teacher trainings a year, and lots and lots and lots of people apply to be applied to the training, and they only select like a small number, like 60 people per training or whatever. So Bridie's getting all these applications and she's reading through them. And one of the questions that they ask on the application is, what is the hardest thing you've ever had to go through? What's the hardest experience you've ever had in your life? And like 9 times out of 10, the response was people saying, moving away from home, going to university for the first time.
Transition.
It's a major shift.
Huge.
It's a major life shift.
It's insane. Yeah.
And you don't know. And like what you like to that degree, and because there's no conversation around it, I would have had no education surrounding the signs that what might come up for a person who is going through a depressive state. And as it relates to somebody who might be going through something that ends up going down a much more serious road. You know, I ended up making some friends. Hockey season started. That started to lift. I got into my groove at school and then it was all good. But for somebody going through something where that doesn't lift and to not know the signs to ask for help or to have a support system to give help, I mean, you know, the conversation is so important.
So many of the things you see out there are focused on like 1 in 5. 1 in 5 people will suffer from a mental illness in their lifetime or each year. But very little about everyone else. Mm-hmm. And it's the idea, one of the messages that Jack.org is trying to spread and all the students across Canada is that it's not about the 1 in 5 for 2 reasons. One, every one of us has mental health. It goes up and down every day.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's my favorite
moments
thing.
Like you, you're not necessarily someone that suffers from depression, but you can go through a time of depression.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not able to like recognize what that is and all that stuff, you're not going to speak to someone. Mm. You're not going to get help. It may turn into something worse.
Right.
But just the idea of like, take it away from extreme illnesses. Those are going to be there.
Yeah.
People are going to need treatment. They're going to need professional support. But all of us need to understand that we have mental health, that it goes up and down, and that you need to take care of it. Just like if your leg's hurting, you're going to stretch it a little bit because it's a little tight.
Right.
That's the thing that I took from Jack that was the mind-blowing thing. That was like, oh my God, yeah. I never consider my mental health ever. I'm always thinking about my physical health, like my body, you know, oh, I have a stomach ache. What do I do? Well, I got to do something to like take care of that. Or, oh, I know that if I like eat this particular thing, it's going to have an effect on me this way. Or I know that if I don't exercise, it's going to have an effect on me this way. But never do you really sit and think about how to proactively take care of your mental health. And that idea of like, we all have mental health. Cause I think before that moment, I would hear mental health and I would just think, oh, mental illness.
Mental illness, exactly.
Right, yeah.
But they're two very different things, but they're two very similar things as well.
And the other side of the 5 in 5 is, we also, like the message out there in media and everywhere right now is reach out, ask for help. And the reality is, if you reach out and ask for help, you're generally not going to get it unless you have a significant amount of money to pay for private treatment. You're going to wait 6 months to a year to see a counselor, if that person's even good for you, or a psychologist or whatever, and then you got to go through 5 different ones to find someone that works for you.
Yeah.
And at the same time, your friends and your family generally don't know what to say. That's why stigma exists, because we're not educated well enough. So if we just continue to put it on those 1 in 5 and then that person stands up, reaches out and asks for help, but can't get professional help for a year, and their friends and family say the wrong things, well, then what are we doing? Are we actually digging a bigger hole? So the other side is, it's great to break down stigma. It's great to have conversation and tell everyone to have a conversation and be comfortable talking. But if we're not at the same time educating each other on how to be there for each other, so in those 6 months, I can say to Taylor, like, hey, how you doing? And understand and look for signs that like he may be struggling more and mm-hmm. say something if he is. So I repeat it a lot, and it's pretty simple, but like we need to do a better job being there for each other. And you do that by educating yourself. Right now, there happens to really not be many resources to educate yourself, mm-hmm. so we have to create them. But ask questions, be comfortable looking for what signs of struggle are, say something. The amount of time someone says, today it happened to me at the Briss. I have a family member who seems suicidal in Vancouver. Do you know any walk-in places? Do you know any? And the answer, people are afraid to ask someone if they're struggling that yeah. much. Don't be afraid. The worst thing that happens is you piss off a friend. The best thing that happens, I guess, is you piss off a friend. The worst thing is they kill themselves. It's preventable.
Yeah.
It's a simple message. It's preventable. The end is the end, period. Say something. Like, do something about it.
This work that you're doing, I'm wondering, like, you know, what led you to this? Is this something that you just kind of stumbled into through just a, you know, a series of like events, or did you have experience in like worrying about your own mental health? Or
personally, I'm really lucky in that my mental health is pretty great, and that I don't struggle with really anything that's serious.
Rub it in, dude.
Every up and down that anyone else would have.
Yeah.
But no, I dated a girlfriend of mine a few years ago who would be totally comfortable with me sharing this. And she struggles with an eating disorder. And I worked in mental health. I worked from November for 6 years and definitely knew the men's side of things, but not how significant of an effect, at least I didn't see, it has on someone's life. And dating her for 2.5 years and living with her, I learned a lot. And part of what I learned was how hard it is to be there for someone and how hard it is to learn what to say, what not to say, how to do it. And how to truly support that person. And through it, I learned a lot. But the biggest thing was we need to do a better job teaching each other how to be there. And that led me down the path of like wanting to be full on in mental health and working in mental health and trying to bring people together. And then we've spoken about this recently, about 5 months ago. During all of this, lost my cousin who died from drug-related issues. She was addicted to heroin and was through rehab and in and out of rehab a couple times, and then living in a sober living home and doing okay. And I guess she relapsed, and whatever it was, it wasn't an overdose, but whatever it was, whatever drug it was, we're still waiting to hear, it stopped her heart. So that just... Alicia was my age, grew up with her, my best friend. So it just further pushed me down that hole, and that, I still deal with the grief part of it every day. But from the other side is like, what can you do, to live in her honor? So part of that for me is she was like that hippy dippy all over the place, you know, spells things wrong just because it's fun and weird to spell things wrong. And so just like to love more and push a little bit harder for people to, you know, be vulnerable with one another, have fun. And so, yeah, that's kind of where it led me to where I am.
Did you find that your experience in dealing with mental health, did that prepare you to deal with that grief?
No, I've never dealt with real grief before. I've lost people in my life, but no one that was like a full on tragedy. Should not like they're not young and incredibly spirited and just should they, their life was they're too young. And no one that's been that close to me that I've had a true incredible relationship with. And I wasn't prepared for it. And honestly, I don't think you can ever be prepared for that sort of thing. What I found amazing, not necessarily in a positive way, just interesting, was seeing all of my family deal with grief in such different ways. I generally could only really feel emotion when I was alone. And so like when everyone was like with each other, cause we were in the hospital for a few days, when everyone was with each other, like kind of in the waiting room or in her room, I didn't feel, and I'm a pretty vulnerable person that can like share emotion and that sort of thing. I had to walk away from everyone, and that's when I would like truly feel things and being alone. There was a lot of anger both towards myself, towards her, towards the world, to kind of everyone, and still dealing with it on a daily basis, but trying to channel it through doing good things.
Why do you think you couldn't express that emotion, like, around your loved ones, around that, like, family?
I don't know why. I think the feeling I got was just, like, I couldn't connect with her when I was with them. I was having them around was comforting, but I needed to, like, break down a little bit. Yeah. And I don't think it was a strength thing. Like, I don't want to break down in front of people. Just for whatever reason, I needed to back away a little bit. And then you see other people that are like rocks, just rocks. And you know they're struggling, but they're able to come out and talk and update you and talk to the family and, like, just be that rock for the family. And everyone kind of plays their role, which is pretty incredible to see.
Ooh. Something that Drew Dudley said, well, we before the live show last night, we were hanging around with Drew and shooting the shit and kind of talking about what we were going to chat about during the show. And something that he said, which was really fascinating that I immediately clicked with, was that in I think December or January, he lost his girlfriend to suicide. And he said, I still haven't really cried yet. Like, I haven't had that breakthrough emotional experience. And when you're at the funeral, it's hard. Like, how do you process your grief? Because you're at the funeral going, thinking to yourself, am I doing this right? Like, am I grieving properly? And my grandmother died last spring. And I remember being there, and she was 91. Like, you know, she lived an amazing life. She was an amazing woman. And I remember being there and not being that emotional. And I chalked it up to that I lost her because she had a full life and she faded away because she of old age. And I chalked it up to that. But I also was kind of going, like, I felt for the first time almost self-conscious about what other people thought of how I was dealing with it. Mm-hmm. And I was so self-aware of that. And, and it wasn't until the exact same with you. It wasn't until I could be really by myself that I actually had a good cry about it and could actually really grieve. Cause I didn't know how to do that in front of a room of people.
Yeah. I think I would imagine everyone goes through those grieving, like, am I doing this right? Yeah, not just like what other people see, but like, what am I doing? I definitely sat. I still do. Of like, there's this song that really reminds me of her by Fish. And I put that on at night quite a bit and it makes me happy. Mm. And that makes me be like, what the hell? Yeah. This shouldn't make me, like, it's reminding me of something that is really fresh, really, hopefully the most tragic thing that will ever happen in my life. Mm. And this song is making me happy. And I think the reasoning would probably be because it makes a connection to her. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I'm connecting with her, but like there's always that, at least with me, it's been, now you're saying it. And I think a lot of people feel the same way. Like, I should be crying. I should be a mess, but I'm standing here and I'm like strong. Like, yeah. What's wrong with me?
Yeah. Do you think that you, like, I mean, so I haven't experienced grief in it really, like, closely. And, you know, we just recently spoke with Candace Reed, who is the wife of a guest that we had on the show who passed away, Leighton Reed. He passed away in January. And we were talking about grief with her and how she grieved. And one of the things that she did, and obviously, like, her situation was, like, very, very intense. You know, they had a child together, and he's, you know, Finn's only, what, like, 3 years old. And so obviously for her, there's a lot, she felt the need to, like, kind of research and do a lot of reading and sort of investigate, like, what it is to grieve and how to grieve and how do you do that with a child and all those sorts of things. Has your grieving process been a very introspective kind of just observing how you're grieving in one way, or is there, because this is so close to you, have you done any sort of research and reading into how to grieve or?
No, not really. Maybe a little bit at the beginning, but generally no. It's been a process for me that I kind of have just gone with the flow.
Yeah.
I've done the research thing. When I was dating my ex, I did a lot of research, and that's where I kind of came to that realization that there's nothing out there to teach you how to be there for someone. Mm-hmm. And that was like a daily Googling deep, dark parts of forums that like no one's probably ever read. But the grief piece have just been a kind of go with the flow, see what happens. For me, that's included bringing her friends together and being around people I haven't had a relationship with in 15 years, but I grew up with like her best friend I haven't spoken to in probably 8 years. And who she was my first kiss when I was 8 years old behind cabin B at summer camp. And like, we're talking again. She's married, so nothing's happening there. But it's just been about bringing people together. And like, something so horrible, I think, can go two ways for a family. It can tear a family apart and you just don't know how to relate to each other anymore, or it can bring it together. And for us, I think it's brought us together quite a bit. And that's been pretty incredible in regards to helping, I guess, the grieving process. But no, it hasn't been a research thing for me. It's just been really, truly trying to make myself a little bit more easygoing, a little bit more open, a little more friendly, and to do that because that's how she'll live through us.
The thing that I find that's really interesting is that there's, when you talk about grief, especially when grieving a loss of someone very, very, very close to you, it's like this whole new level of emotions that is sometimes never, like very rarely or infrequently experienced or never experienced until later in your life. And it's interesting to try to understand how or what is the right way to react to this brand new emotion that you're experiencing for the first time when you're like 25, 30 years old.
Like when we were 15, 16 and we lost a friend of ours.
Yeah. And I remember when the first time a close friend of mine, I sat by her in every single class that semester. And I was away when we found out that she had been hit by a car in a crosswalk and died. And the first time I found out and somebody told me, I laughed because
you just don't believe it.
I didn't believe it. I didn't believe it was real. And it was like this overwhelming feeling that I just couldn't describe, but there was no tears. It was like shock, number one, but some type of sadness for sure. But I just didn't feel like my brain had the pathways to understand how to react properly.
Did you laugh because you thought it was a joke and you were laughing at the joke? Or did you because like you did understand and it was just this random like way to emote?
I don't think I thought it was a joke because like that would be a really sick and twisted joke for somebody to make. And also the way that the person said it.
It felt real,
but it was almost like my brain thought this is so impossible and can't possibly be true that it has to be something else. And it was just like this emotional reaction to the news that I didn't understand how to comprehend.
Well, at that time in your life, you think your idea of death is that happens later.
Yeah.
That's a thing that happens down the road. That doesn't happen now. And you, dude, you wear some of your grief on your hand. Like it's imprinted into you.
I sat in class like a month and a half after and was still trying to understand. And I remember sitting next to a chair where my friend used to sit and I just had a pen and I was, Her number in hockey was 14, and I just started drawing and tracing it over and over in my hand until it bled. And like I have a scar on my hand to this day from doing that. And as a 16-year-old kid, it's like, how else do you react? You're not taught that. It's not something that you're familiar with in any way, and it just hits you like a ton of bricks, and you don't know how to respond to it.
It's so funny. Like, you know, we're talking about the importance of acknowledging our mental health and, you know, being proactive in taking care of our mental health in the same way that we would be proactive in taking care of our physical health, and talking about like exploring grief, and, you know, dealing with that kind of on your own. And there's a whole slew or plethora, if you will, two of my favorite words, of things that like we are
adjectives.
not that we are not taught in school.
Yeah.
That just seems so like bonkers to me. That is not
completely,
like
completely bonkers.
It's like, so, you know, we have phys ed. Yep. We have a class where they go, hey, move your body, like throw a ball,
yeah,
run, fucking yep, take care of your body, fitness. Like you'd have to be fit.
And they great, start simple and they get more complicated.
And they get more complicated.
And they yeah, don't do that at all with like, how do we be people?
How, yeah. Like, I mean, yeah, like, fucking like, let's talk about, hard, let's talk about taxes. I mean, you know, like things like there's so many things that you don't get taught in school that I, to me, it just seems,
but that's a really good point with the phys ed point is like, why don't we have the
mental
equal and opposite yeah, for mental?
Yeah.
Why doesn't that exist? And I mean, I'm assuming that's like jack.org is trying to totally insert
itself. It's a hole we're trying to fill. And that's like, we have different programming. Jack Talks is one of them is kind of the intro to everything. And it's young people that are trained, speakers that go in, usually they're high, university or college students. They go into high schools and speak to an auditorium full of usually the entire school, and it's the initial conversation into what is mental health, how do you identify it. It's on a spectrum. Some people are far on the spectrum that would be mental illness, but we're all on it. Mm-hmm. And that sort of idea is what we're trying to do. It's actually Nova Scotia was, I believe, the first, and this is recent. They're now introducing mental health into their curriculum.
Oh,
I believe
wow,
it's, don't quote me on this, I believe it's starting at grade 8. But it's a significant yeah, investment
that's
awesome, into
that's a pretty good time,
mental health into the curriculum. Mm. It's starting.
Cool
it's
that Nova Scotia
near where it needs to be. Totally. Yeah. And I think other places will follow suit, but it's, yeah, the schooling system does not teach you how to be a resilient person with your mind, which it should.
I really love the what you said earlier about it's not about the 1 in 5, it's about the 5 in 5, yeah, and teaching everybody, you know, how do you recognize it within yourself? How do you try to talk about it, and how does the other 80% be a support and be educated? You know, we've done I don't know how many episodes on mental health, and obviously that has been a massive help for me. I remember what I do remember is the first time we talked about mental health, and I was scared shitless. I mentioned that last night at the live show. I was so scared. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't know, what am I like? I don't want to flip a switch. I don't want to send her into a spiral. I don't want to say something offensive. I don't want to break her. I'm nervous about myself. I'm self-conscious about what I'm going to say. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. And over time, repeating that process, and it's hard in life, especially if you don't have a podcast where you schedule someone to come in and talk about yeah, it. It's challenging to build up enough experience to the point where you feel comfortable. But I've only had one experience where I've had one experience in my life where a friend of mine who is taking our teacher training, we split our teacher training up into 2 9-day pieces, and they're separated by a few months. And about half, we were coming up to doing the second module, the second piece. And she wrote me a message and said, and I knew that she struggled with some mental health issues. And she said, I don't think I can do the second 9 days because of XYZ. And I said, okay, let's meet up. Are you okay? Do you want to meet up and chat? And we sat down and we had this super open conversation about her mental health and where she is and how to try to process it in a way where she could still take in our training if she felt at the end of the day after we sussed it out that that would be beneficial for her. And I mean, it was an ideal situation. It was someone who was open to talk about it mm-hmm, from her end, and someone who was open to try to support on my end. But it was this way where what we do here in the podcast and my experience with educating ourselves through what we do here, where I put it into practice in real life, and the outcome was perfection.
Yeah. And so just think about if it's worked into the fucking curriculum at schools.
Yeah.
You know, starting at the age of whatever, 15 or 14, like, dude, if that was a thing across the board from coast to coast, I feel like that would just have profound effects.
Oh my God.
You know, if it became like a, you can't not take phys ed, I don't think. Is that true?
I didn't take it in high school.
Oh, but
I
really?
Think at some point it's like math. At some point, stop taking it.
Yeah, yeah.
It should start at, but like in an ideal world though, like in elementary school, because it's the same way, Jared, that like you talk about finding out that CF was would shorten your life expectancy. If you talk about mental health from when as early as you can start to understand the concept of it, then it just becomes something that's second nature and not something that's introduced later on that is harder to understand because of the I guess maybe misguided ways that you think about it because you don't have that early education.
100%. Well, as you're saying that, I was thinking like, if you don't teach it early on, we just come up with our own assumptions.
Right.
Yeah. Most of that is going to be from movies and things like that, which show mental health or mental illness as like someone running down the hallways of an insane asylum as a schizophrenic and they scare the shit out of you.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's what I,
a horror
film. That's what I thought of when I thought about schizophrenia. And I was young walking downtown with my dad and some guy starts yelling at me and I'm like scared shitless of that guy. I shouldn't be scared of that guy. But unless we're teaching it early on that we can have those, we can understand what mental health is. We can understand that people go through things and we learn about it. And some of that stuff is so simple. Like Taylor, you were just saying that you're essentially what held you back from having a conversation was fear.
Yeah.
And if you put yourself in that person's shoes for a second, because we all do that until we learn otherwise, that person, now that person thinks that anyone that knows that they have an issue is going to be tiptoeing around them. That's not a way to live. Like that person's not going, they may be insulted by something you ask. Being insulted by something you ask is way worse than you just not having a real relationship and people not having real conversations with you. And I think what you guys have found on this show is no matter how crassly you put it, no matter how forward you put it, people are open to having a conversation around it. And it's, I mean, the going back to what I said at the beginning was the hardest thing for me was learning how to be there for people. It still is. When someone in my life that I'm close to needs support, it's every single person is different, even if they're the same illness as someone else. My thing that I go back to, there's quite a few, like kind of four or five simple things. One of them is be curious and ask questions. Like be curious about what that person is going through. Ask questions. Don't stop asking questions because you need to try to better understand what it's like in their shoes. But also, how do I be there for you? Like when someone's really struggling and they're going through a manic episode or they're kind of the extreme end of depression or just having a really bad day, it's probably not the time to ask them how to be there for them. But you do what you can to support them in whatever way that is. It might be giving them a hug. It might be sitting there with them, not touching them. It may be talking them through it. But the key part of that is when they're in a better state of mind and they're doing a little bit better, and that might be in an hour and it might be in 3 days, ask, like, how did what I do help? Did it help at all? Did I make it worse? And if not, or what could I have done better? Or what would you have wanted me to do in that situation? And I feel like people are afraid of having those conversations.
Yeah.
That's when we need to stop, like, have an open and honest conversation like you would about anything else.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
And in that curiosity piece, like you said, if it, you know, it's better to ask a question that might insult them to, than to not ask the question at all or not have the conversation or the relationship. And sometimes, and a lot of times, the questions that you ask that aren't necessarily the best are probably going to teach you the most about how to go about it differently the next time. And it's like anything in life. It's the things that you do wrong that teach you about how to do it right. And
but
like,
I mean, we fucked up on this show, you know what I mean? Like, and, and we learn from it, you know, and we, and you know, we get people that, and here's the fucking beautiful thing about it. Sure. We say stuff that, that might not be the right thing to ask. Like last night, Drew, you know, it, we did this live show with Drew Dudley and we're talking about his, you know, the passing of his girlfriend in a really traumatic way. And I said, how are you? So like my question is, you know, we talked about all this stuff, but Drew, how are you? And his response was, don't ever ask someone that. Don't ask me that. Because I don't have an answer. And I would never have known to not say that to him, right? Mm-hmm. And sure, maybe there's some people that go, I want you to ask me how I am.
How did that's the thing,
right? Yeah. And you might feel differently, but in hearing him say that and having him explain why he doesn't want me to say, how are you to him, it at least gives me a point of a place to like reconsider how it is I'm going to approach someone in the future, knowing that they're going through something very challenging.
And I think what you learn from that is there's no hard and fast rules.
That's right.
And if a person's thinking, I think the right way around mental health is, and we mentioned this a little bit already, but someone with depression, someone with an eating disorder, someone with schizophrenia, all deal, like you have no idea, just because you're schizophrenic doesn't mean you know how this guy's mind's working or this mm-hmm. girl's mind is working. And so that piece of, there's no like hard and fast rules. Here's the 10 things you need to know about being there for someone that is going to work for everyone. But things like being curious, asking questions, the reason you're doing it is to get to know that person, be in a better situation, to feel like you can put yourself in their shoes a little bit, mm-hmm. And try to empathize. And the more questions we ask, the more we can empathize and the more we understand how to be there for that individual person, and probably a little bit better for everyone in general. But yeah, I totally get where Drew is coming from. Mm-hmm. I think you asked different people that same question, they would appreciate it, because you just asked it in a way that was very much not like, how are you? It's, how are you? Like, how are you?
I
want to
know how you're doing. Yeah. But and not to say that I would never ever ask that question mm-hmm. to someone again in the future, but I might come at it from a different from a different way.
There's different ways to do it. Right. It wasn't from that question, but it was actually from a crowd question after that McKean asked was like, well, when your mom was diagnosed with cancer and the next time I saw you, I just gave you a hug. I didn't say anything to you. I didn't really ask you about it. I just gave you a hug. I held you for 10 or 15 seconds mm-hmm. and then we continued to be best friends. And it's like a subtle, yo, dude, you know that if
I'm
you
here.
Ever need me, mm-hmm. I'm here for this conversation and I'm here for you and I'm here for your mom. And mm-hmm. that contact is those words.
Yeah. And I do think that like with our relationship as guys like Taylor and Jer, we just know that we have that relationship with one another too. So it almost makes it a little bit easier
to do that.
But it's like, it's that person that you interact with on a daily basis, but might not be best of friends with, that you know is going through a challenging situation. How do you approach them? Because those people who are a little bit further removed, but the people that you still want to be there for and support, mm-hmm. it's a little bit more challenging to let them know that you're there with like that, a simple gesture like that, and have and to already have that connection.
Yeah.
But the nod that Drew gave mm-hmm. the example of from like mm-hmm. one guy to another guy, just that nod of, hey, we both know what's on our minds. I'm acknowledging that I know how you feel. You're acknowledging that you've received that. And if you want to talk about it, I'm here. But just by body language.
I hate like referring to past episodes, especially because a lot of people just are like, well, I haven't heard that yet. And so not to like take a moment to plug, but if you want to listen to that episode, go over to our Patreon page and
give us
some of your money and then you can listen to it because it's up on Patreon, like all of our other live shows. But that little head nod thing that Drew was talking about, like a guy to guy kind of like the nod of like, hey, I'm here for you.
And it could even be like a ball caress.
Maybe. I mean, depending on how close
subtle
you are.
Genital touching.
That nod thing, I feel like for me would work really well
when
I know that person. Like if I'm going through something and someone looks at me. So we talked about the nod all the time at Movember, and it had a very similar thing of like, you're looking at someone and you're like, yeah, we're doing this together. Mm-hmm. It was more about Movember and like kind of bro code.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's like the Dave Chappelle bit where he's like, the terrorists are on the plane. The terrorists are going to blow up the plane. And like Dave and it's only one other black guy on the plane, and they look at each other and they nod at each other like, yeah, I'm with you. And then all the white people in the plane are like, oh my God, I think these black men are about to take out the terrorists. But really, they're just like, no, fuck that shit. Like, we're safe. We're safe. I want to talk about your, maybe not your time at Movember, but, you know, Movember's played a huge role in supporting what we've been doing. Totally. You know, like, we've recorded in their space. We've done live shows at the office here in Toronto. And they're up to some, like, really rad stuff. And you worked with them for a while. Mm-hmm. And so for those who don't know, like, what Movember's kind of, like, MO is, why don't you just kind of fill...
Was that a pun?
No, it actually wasn't, but it is now.
Movember has changed so much over the years, and I mean that in that originally Movember started over a conversation, which I think you guys have spoken about this on the show a little bit. It was just a conversation in a bar about things that had gone out of style and not come back in, and they settled on mustaches. And that's like the fun part of how it began. It was two guys having a drink. They asked their friends to grow mustaches with them. There was no reason. It succeeded. People were loving it, so they wanted to put a cause behind it. They thought that the mustache could be for men's health what the pink ribbon has been for women's health.
Right.
And so they looked into men's health, and they found that prostate cancer was the male equivalent to breast cancer. Similar amount of people being diagnosed, similar amount of people dying, yet no one was talking about it. No one was funding it. And no researchers were going into it because there's no money there.
Right.
And so they decided to raise funds. There's a whole long story that comes with getting prostate cancer going and reaching out to the Prostate Cancer Foundation in Australia, but they...
Because that's where it started in Australia.
That's where it started in Australia, yeah. And they kind of got laughed at quite a bit when they reached out and said, we're going to grow mustaches and change the face of men's health. It's obviously a pretty funny thing to say, especially prior to Movember. And it blew up. And they have done incredible things. So it started within prostate cancer because that was the biggest need for men, and it's moved from prostate to testicular to now men's mental health. Prostate cancer has, in 10 years, via Movember, moved 50 years compared to what other cancers would be. It is coming to the point where in our lifetime, in the next 5 to 10 years, no man is going to die of prostate cancer. They might die with prostate cancer, but they won't die from it as long as they take care of it and they get checked. That is really almost solely because of what Movember's done and challenging cancer researchers to work together and have no choice but to work together. And they are able to do that because they were and are such a big player in the prostate cancer space. If you're not going to do it our way, you're not going to do it on. Now they've obviously moved into men's mental health, which is a whole nother thing. You have 3 times the amount of men killing themselves as women.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, wow.
That the stat? That's the stat?
That's the stat. 3 times as many. More women attempt suicide, more men actually kill themselves.
Wow.
So who knows the psychological reasoning behind that is a whole nother thing.
Yeah.
But men are severely underdiagnosed with any sort of mental illness compared to women. Yet we're killing ourselves at an alarmingly higher rate. And it's likely, if you talk to me about it, it's we raise men to not share, not talk, not be comfortable with their emotions.
Yeah, stuff it down, right? Yeah. Stuff it, just fucking force it down. Yep. Don't think of a cute little kitten. What's the Bill Burr, Bill Burr's whole thing, you see a cute kitten, something starts welling up, you stuff that shit down.
Stuff it down and put it in a deep, dark place.
Well, and so that whole mentality of stuff it down and don't acknowledge and sweep it under the rug, is that one of the reasons why there was such a lack of advocacy and awareness and funding behind prostate cancer? Like, because it's a men's health issue and men are like, well, we don't fucking acknowledge that shit.
I would say largely. Yeah. I would imagine that it would have been. And if you look at everything else when it comes to men and our health, we are much worse at talking about things. Look at the biggest killer in mental health for mental illnesses is eating disorders. More people die from eating disorders than any other mental illness.
Even through men?
Well, here's the thing. Men, if you look up the stats of eating disorders, men account for a very small portion of eating disorders. But it's also eating disorders are the most stigmatized mental illness. And then if you move to the male side, now we're talking about real stigma around eating disorders. In the gay community, they're a little bit more open about it. It's probably more prevalent as well because there's such massive demand on men that are gay to have incredible bodies and just be portraying this like, 6-8-pack
right.
beautiful being.
Me. You're me, essentially.
And
just a slick, sexy otter of a man. Slick myself,
stuff.
Yeah.
Cool stuff.
But the... The symptoms of male eating disorders and what it looks like often presents itself quite differently. So our doctors aren't really looking for it. So if you look at like bulimia, people think bulimia is purging and purging is puking. Well, purging isn't puking. Purging is doing anything to get something out of your body. It might be taking a laxative. In a lot of men's cases that do have eating disorders, it's going to the gym. And it's going to the gym for 5 hours. And if you can't go to the gym, if you don't go to the gym for those 5 hours and it's having a severe effect on your life, well, you have an issue and you have an unhealthy relationship with food or working out or whatever else. And so that same thing happens around men all over the place, whether it's just general mental illness or cancer and prostate cancer. Of like, I can't imagine it's anything else other than, women are better at talking about it. You know, maybe breasts are more marketable than prostates.
Yeah, yeah.
Like there's, I'm sure there's a bunch of reasons, but the biggest one across the board would be men aren't comfortable being vulnerable. And if you go back to what Brian was saying about being there for each other and that look and that sort of thing is, and I'm sure you guys get it all the time, is now that you're so comfortable having conversations and being vulnerable yourselves, everyone, as soon as you are that person, reaches out to you and tells you a story about something
that's
they've been
through. Yeah, it's like it builds this sense of trust and it builds this sense of like, of camaraderie that you know
it's safety
that's it, right? It's you feel safe to like talk to someone who is okay with being vulnerable. I mean,
and as soon as those people too reach out, then it's almost like they in turn can become that person for somebody else too.
Yeah.
Which is all like that's the whole like exponential growth of that support system.
What do you think is, so it's hard to tell from, you know, when you're in it, when you're in the bubble, it's hard to, you think that it's all happening. Yeah. What's your perspective on how the conversation around men's mental health or mental health in general is growing in terms of the broad population? I mean, we work in this space, so I see it like kind of really swelling and I'm like, yeah, it seems awesome. It's, I mean, you know, obviously there's always work to do, but you're happy and really excited about the growth that's happening. And you work in the same space. Right. So are you able to look outside of the bubble and see the kind of more broader effect?
I think you get caught in the bubble sometimes. And I think that's across the board. If it's Sick Boy, let's say, and it's hard to be critical or you're too critical of something that you're so close to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think within mental health and mental illness, I think there is a massive bubble happening. And I think there is change happening. I think from the perspective of like socially conscious 30 plus year olds or 25 to 35s, we're stuck in this bubble of people that are fairly privileged, are around and are part of that group that are standing up and saying like, we're inclusive. We believe in like, you do you and whatever that is, we're going to support it. But that truthfully, that is not what's happening. And I've seen that a few times. Like that is not what's happening everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
If we step out a little bit outside of our network of people, I think you'll see that there's still a ton of homophobia. There's still a ton of people that don't believe in mental illness, that think we're soft. Like this generation of young people is soft, which to me is not the fact that you think that you can be homophobic, that, but if we step out a little bit,
I think
we see that.
I think a great reminder of that is every time there's a major election, all that shit comes out and you go, whoa, oh, yeah.
There are people that think that way.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the whole racism thing and
crazy.
And like Islamophobia and all that stuff that went on with Trump. Like, you know, you start going, you know, we obviously all of our friends are not racist. Mm-hmm. So then when something comes up and you see that there's racism in the world, you go, whoa.
Just racism, but like intense.
Yeah, like racism. Intense, like not just subtle stuff, but like blatant, I hate that.
The sad part too is when you find out that there's more of those people than there are not those people. And it's not like looking at Donald Trump getting elected doesn't necessarily mean that there's more racists or more people who are homophobic, but the fact that there's a president who gets elected after mm-hmm. like projecting those ideals is insane to me.
Well, it's like, you know, it's the bubble thing. It's so wrapped up in the way that we use social media. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like so many of us we're so selective in what we choose to acknowledge in our feed that we see hundreds of times a day. You know, like how many fucking times a day do you pick up your phone to look at your Instagram feed or your Facebook feed? It's consistent. It's constant. And we're the ones who choose. We're the ones who cater what that feed is. And when something comes up, oftentimes when something comes up that you disagree with and that you think is like, I cannot believe they said that. Ugh. Unfollow.
Yeah.
Delete. Wipe you away from like existence so I don't have to see it.
Right.
Yeah, and then you forget about it.
Yeah. I don't want anybody on here who isn't confirming my bias.
Which is also
if you go down the path of saying something, you end up being that person on Facebook or Instagram that gets in like a long conversation with someone that's like to the point where they're so stubborn they'll never change. I was in Burlington. And just like to step outside of the circle a little bit, I went for this rugby thing and we all dressed in like tight and bright. This was last year, right around like election time. And I was wearing, I think like pink socks up to my knees, a pink like fluffy shirt I'd gotten from, like really tight fluffy shirt I'd gotten from Bally Village.
This is like a big rugby sort of tradition, isn't
it? Like dressing up. Yeah. It was another rugby club, but I was just going out with a couple friends with them. And I was leaving and waiting for like food from like the shawarma guy outside. And I don't remember the conversation completely, but this woman looks at me, she's probably 30 plus years old, and goes, "You look really gay."
Whoa.
And I'm used to Toronto, right? Like,
yeah.
You can't say things like that to people in Toronto or everyone around you is going to say. And I looked
really
at her,
gay.
I was like, okay. Like, do you have an issue with it? And I'm like, not being controversial at all, not or confrontational, but I'm not going to say nothing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm like, is there an issue with that? And she's like, well, I just think you should know that you look like a faggot.
Whoa!
Like literally in front of people, like there's other people hearing this. And I looked at her and I don't know what to say in that situation other than like, hey, I don't really know what issue you have with that. I don't really care that you think I look like a faggot at all. But I hope you grow up someday. Like, grow up and teach yourself something.
Yeah.
Because, like, I feel bad for you.
That is so intense.
And I don't want to, like, be too much of an asshole there.
Yeah.
Because, like, I do. Go home and, like, feel bad about yourself a little bit and, like, educate yourself and don't be an asshole.
Because being an asshole to them is going to reconfirm their aggression towards you. Because that's all that shit does. Totally,
You'll never change anybody's mind by being angry back at them.
Yeah. You know? But what a stark reminder, right? That it is a bubble. Yeah. Like, we happen to, like, live in these bubbles and we forget. And we forget that this is
a thing. And that's the negative side. But there is the positive side of, like, that bubble does exist. That bubble is huge. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of people that do care, and they're generally the ones that are louder socially. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully as time goes, that bubble gets bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. That bubble bursts and bursts all over everyone else.
Just to like kind of tie it all the way back to why we got into this is like, you know, asking if this all this talk about mental health and you know, being vulnerable as men and all those kinds of things and surrounding yourself with those kinds of people, how big is that bubble getting? And is that like, is there an effect? Are you seeing change? And I don't know if you answered it or not, but like when you do step outside of that bubble and not like looking at the shitty people of the world bubble, but like is mental health or the conversations around mental health, the conversations around men's health, are you seeing that sort of bubble broaden?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest thing you can take from that is, I mean, the broadening is happening. More people are talking about it. If you looked at like stats and PR and media and all that, conversations are growing and growing every year. More money is being funneled into it for both awareness and education and research, which is fantastic. We do not understand mental illness enough at all from a research scientific perspective. There's some really cool like experimental treatment that are going on or just treatment in general that would blow your mind about the effect they can have when it like you just it's hard to see the connection between the two. I can explain it. But I think the conversation is definitely happening. It is widening. There's still shittiness out there of people that have heavy stigma and all that jazz. But on the other side, I think we just, that's makes it more important for the people in those bubbles to keep pushing themselves outside of their boundaries and having conversations with people that are stubborn and have a certain way of looking at things. And I have a really good friend of mine. She's incredible. She's probably the, had the biggest effect on my life in regards to understanding other people and being empathetic and understanding their situations, where they come from, and knowing that you'll never be able to really understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And her piece is really around, she gets at times worked up, is where I was going with that. And she's such a good teacher. She has taught me so much, but can get really worked up when someone is ignorant.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important. We've had the I've had the conversation with her both back and forth about so many things. One of them is, how do you deal with those people and what do you do? Like, what's your job as someone that's trying to hopefully make the world a better place and just be a good person? And she's so quick to be mad at that person that in the conversation we had is like, you lose a possible teaching opportunity.
Yeah, a learnable moment. Yeah.
For me, it's like, ask that person where it's coming from. Like, oh, okay, like without disagreeing with them, just like, tell me about that. Why do you think that? And then like they can tell you why if they're open and tell you why. And then hopefully you can be like, hey, have you ever thought about it that this other way? That's for me quite clearly and so obvious, and for all of you it would be as well. But for them it's not. And just like, how do we hold back anger a little bit and hopefully look at crappy situations as teaching opportunities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fuck, this is a great conversation.
Fuck yeah.
I love definitely. This. I love these. This is great. Good job, guys. I think this whole thing was a real good learnable moment.
Yeah, this was all very learnable. Learned. Very learned.
Yeah. We stuck to the script and sounded pretty compelling too, like made this sound pretty real.
Like as if we were not reading it off a page.
Yeah, which is great.
It's great. Jesse, thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks
for coming
me.
In. It was really, really fun.
Awesome to have a conversation with you guys. Always love when I do and love listening to you guys talk to everyone else. So thank you.
I do want to acknowledge that in terms of just, I know maybe we just cut this out because it's a can of worms that is open and we don't have time to kind of talk about it. But when we were in Toronto last, we meant to record with you and on the topic of grief, and the challenge around losing somebody, we couldn't record with you that day because we had just learned that one of our friends, Matt Amiot, who was one of our first guests on the show, had died. And that was a big bomb that dropped on us that day. And I am so happy that we have come around to getting you on the show. Because at the same time as we had to take that time that day, I really wanted to talk with you. And I'm glad that we made our way back to it.
And we also discussed like possibly just doing the recording anyway because of the topic and because of the, and we thought that, you know, maybe it's good just to talk about this anyway, whether it's something that we put up or we just use it as an opportunity to be four guys talking about something as challenging as losing a friend, right?
Yeah.
And we were also super just hungover, so it was just nice to have a break.
Yeah.
I remember, because Matt was one of your first guests, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I remember when I first started listening to Sick Boy, I remember hearing his story, and he was, of all the people on the show, I think, just so super open and like relaxed.
Hilarious.
Open-minded about it. He was incredible to listen to. Mm-hmm. And I think that says a lot considering the amount of people that you have on this show that are totally comfortable talking about things that are mind-blowing in regards to having like being that vulnerable. And I think it's great that we were able to reschedule. I'm happy we did. I think it's been a fun conversation.
Well, thank you all so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it, and next week we'll be back with another amazing episode, I'm sure. In the meantime, head on over to iTunes. It would mean the world to us, honest to God, if you just took a moment to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes. It keeps us kind of like on the Billboard charts of podcasts. Basically.
Why do you keep saying it every week, dude? It's not like it's that important.
It's pretty important, so I say it every week. And also, we're on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, and you can find out information on our live shows, which we just sold one out in Toronto and did it last night, and it was really fun. And if you missed it, you might want to be at the next one.
That's got to be the third one you sold out.
That was our, actually, we've sold out every live show we've done, which is, I think we're like up to seven now. And it was our second live show in Toronto that we sold out.
Yeah.
It was a good time. We're going to be coming back for sure.
We've also got Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/sickboy. You can contribute there. It's a monthly contribution. You get some awesome exclusive content. And the live shows that we do all go up there, and they're exclusive to people who contribute to Patreon.
I'm super proud of our content that we provide on Patreon. I feel like it's like a really great benefit to those who are big fans of the podcast and those who want to support a good movement.
That was a really awesome pitch, Bri.
Yep.
What's the last thing that we do?
So if you're a Patreon subscriber or patron and you want one of those cool perks, it's 10% off our Sick Boy merch. And you can get that by heading to shop.sickboypodcast.com or just go to sickboypodcast.com and click on the shop link.
You got it. That is it this week.
I'm Brian.
I'm Taylor.
And I'm Jeremy. And this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.